Hey everybody, welcome to another show. I'm on my way home. So how are things holding up? I did my flight out, one of my worst flights yet. It took us, we left 2 hours late, hour and a half late. But it's the worst kind of hour and a half late, because we spent an hour and a half just sitting on the plane. So first thing was, it was really snowy, right? So it was like, but then they were like, I get here and it's like plane delayed 15 minutes. And I was like, okay, that's not even really worth talking about, but that's fine. Because, 15 minutes, am I even going to know that that's a delay versus like it just sort of happened that way this time? I mean, I'm not going to know that. But then we had, we all get on the plane, and there's a bunch of empty seats. And this is one of the things that I hate, is when I'm tricked into believing there might be empty seats on the plane, that makes me furious. Because you're like, I do my best to remain unoptimistic. Because I'm like, there's never fucking empty seats on the plane. Let's not even pretend that that's a possibility. Don't even entertain the notion, is my advice to anyone flying. Don't let yourself think for even a moment, like, maybe there won't be anyone sitting in this middle seat. Because the second you do that, you're setting yourself up for a terrible disappointment. A guaranteed disappointment. So we're sitting there on the plane, middle seat empty. There's quite a few empty seats. And then they get on, they're like, we're still waiting for about 30 passengers. So first I was pissed because I was like, so is this what happens when like people are running late? But then I was like, oh, you know what this must be? This must be a connecting flight. Because that's why they'd be waiting for 30 people. And that's also why you would wait, right? Because otherwise wouldn't you just be like, eh, fuck off. We're not going to make it. But what really annoyed me about it, from the perspective of a flyer, was I was like, you must have known when this other flight left that it was going to get here like 90 minutes late, right? Maybe even 2 hours late, because it's like, the other flight had to be super late, because otherwise they would have made the connection, right? The connection doesn't happen where I'm like, I fly in at 1:15 and fly out at 1:25. There's always like an hour in the middle there. So they must have known whenever that flight left wherever it was that it wasn't going to happen. And so I was just very annoyed because I woke up and because of the weather, I checked the flight's status immediately and was like, all right, well, if this flight is leaving super late or if it's like, if flights aren't happening today or something, I want to know. Because I will just go back to bed and worry about it when I wake up. But that wasn't an option. So what's annoying about it is you know that they know, but they didn't feel like letting me know. Which is like, hey man, I could have slept an extra hour and a half. I mean, legitimately, I could have just been in bed for an hour and a half. Instead of being on an airplane smashed into this tiny little thing, right? Next to a guy who nominated for this trip's worst guy, breath smelled like he ate a log of shit. And I could tell, I could tell when he was looking towards the window that I was seated next to, because I could tell by odor. And I just, I kept the window closed almost the entire flight, because I was just like, well, let's give him nothing to, let's give him nothing to stimulate him towards looking in this direction. Let's just keep him faced the other way, if at all possible. So anyway, it turned a 2.5 hour into a flight into a 4.5 hour flight. And I guess by flight, I mean the flight was still 2.5 hours, but the plane time was almost twice as much. And this is my thing for Frontier. Listen, when you fuck up like that, like when it's your fuck up, because obviously that's what was happening, right? It was transfer from another flight. And if that's what's happening, then it's like, yeah, I mean, that's this is your, you're making us late because you don't want to put these other people on another flight. And I understand that, and that's probably convenient for them too. However, I'm sitting there an hour and a half for doing nothing. I mean, what other thing makes you wait an hour and a half? Like, can you think of another thing in your life that you would be, if you went to the movies and it was starting an hour and a half late, do you think you'd wait? Or do you think you'd be like, well, fuck this shit, I'm out of here. And just, I mean, you would never go back. That would be asinine. If you waited 90 minutes to get on a roller coaster, it had better be a damn good roller coaster, right? And you know when you get in line, you're like, all right, this is how long it's going to be. If you got in line and there was no line in front of you, you were the next person to get on, but the roller coaster just never came around for 90 minutes, wouldn't you just be like, well, fuck this then. Like, never again. Fool me once. But, like, airlines, it's just, that's just what happens. The train that I rode to the airport today, the guy gets on the horn to tell us, gets on the horn. I'm 1,000 years old. He gets on the horn to tell us we're going to be delayed for 3 minutes. 3 minutes. You know, like, I don't know. I don't know whose schedule is so perfect that they can shave it down to 3 minutes. Like, they're like, I get on this train to work and I'm there and I have a 3 minute buffer and now I'm fucked. But it's like that guy got on to tell us about 3 minutes. These people couldn't even update a thing, which they had at least a couple hours, at least a 90-minute notice of, right? They had at least that much notice, and they couldn't get on there to tell us, hey, we're running super late, and so if you came here, you're just going to be sitting around. So if you don't feel like it, I'd skip it. So anyway, it was my worst flight. But you know what? It was the week I had to read. And so I was a little extra motivated to get out there, you know? So I was like, all right, I sent my shit in. If I don't go, then someone else, there's nothing that, you know, the whole thing runs short. So I felt like it was destiny. And I was glad it happened on this one as opposed to another one where maybe I'd be like, I didn't have as much takeaway from this. And so that made the flight a little tougher. I got my critique. It was good. I thought, you know, overall it was like some people made some pretty good points. There's some things I need to fix and whatever. There's definitely some problems I had with the limitation of 10 pages, which I think sounds like a lot, but it's not. It moves along pretty quick. And so there were just entire things I wanted in there that I couldn't get in 10 pages. And some other people had some pretty good ideas of tweaks and little things that I could do to really, I think, amp up the story. So I'd like to see that happen. I know I didn't want to share the things I learned in class, but there are a couple pieces of wisdom this time that I thought were really applicable. One was related to the story someone else read, and basically it was Chuck, and he was just saying, he was talking about this story, what's it called? Hills Like White Elephants, something like that. It's a Hemingway story, and it's a sort of difficult to penetrate, semi-opaque story about abortion, right? And it's all, a lot of it's in dialogue, and it's not like they're talking about it necessarily, but they're kind of talking around it, and so whatever. So it's kind of the kind of story that English teachers love to teach, right? Because they're like, oh, what an example of blah, 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 obfuscation, and whatever. So English teachers love it, but he said, you know, everyone was comparing this story to that story, right? In some similar ways. And he was just like, it was kind of brutal, but he made a good point within it. And he said, I read that too. I read it in, I don't know, seventh grade. And he's like, I didn't even really know what an abortion was. And this English teacher has me reading this story and then like writing a paper about it. And I don't even know what it's about. Like, I'm not old enough to understand the themes. And it's so difficult to understand what's happening that I just got frustrated and, you know, and mad. And he was like, I think the thing is, the worst thing you can do in a story is make the reader feel stupid. If the reader feels stupid, they're going to be angry and they don't want to go on. And I think that's very true. I think that's something that, like, I have, sometimes my artsier fellow writers like these sort of, very artsy, very experimental stories and, you know, write these very artsy, very experimental stories where I think there are a lot of people who like to write a story where it's like, you got to read it twice at least to sort of get it. And once you read it twice, you get it and you'll start to love it. I think those stories are a lot more fun to write than they are to read, though. I had, I'll give you this example. I had this story that I wrote in college, and all the sections of it were mixed up chronologically. Because basically what had happened was one of the characters had suffered this head injury and had difficulty sort of stringing things together in time. So he would have a difficult time remembering, did this happen before that? Like, he could remember most of the events, but sequence was, like, really difficult for him. And so, to replicate that, I wrote a story where that was happening in the story, too. And I tried to give these cues, you know, like, I can't remember exactly what I used, but it would be something along the lines of, like, let's say the World Series is happening, right? So there's, what, game seven? Seven games. And a character is growing a rally beard the whole time. So based on how much beard this character had, we would know where we were, right? That would be a way to place it in time for the reader. That doesn't mean anything to the character. But anyway, so I turned in this story, and the professor was like, this has some great writing in it, and I think you've done some good things here. I think you should try it chronologically, though. I think that what you might get from it chronologically is more than you might get from having it out of order and creating this experience this way. And he was totally right. Like, I did it, and, you know, I was not sure about it, because here's something we get stuck in a lot, right? Writing. We get stuck in, that's how it's supposed to be. You know what I mean? That's kind of the whole point I'm trying to make. But a lot of times I think when someone suggests you do something like tell the story chronologically, and then you say, well, it's supposed to be that way, it's like, they know you're aware that it's not chronological, right? Like, someone reading my story knows that I made it non-chronological. I don't think that's a surprise to anyone. They're trying to nicely tell you that that's not working, that that's not really gaining you much, and that, like, what you lose in the mixed up chronology is probably more valuable than what you gain from it. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting thing to say. And I mean, I totally vibed with the idea of they make you read these, like, impenetrable classics in school, and then you hate them. And it's like, I think he's kind of right. Like, I think that you hate these things as a kid because they're complex and you feel stupid. And, like, I'm not, you know me, I'm not a big believer in the whole, oh, we gotta, like, always be patting each other on the back and never a negative word and stuff like that. But I do think that there's something in the idea of don't make the person reading your story feel stupid. Like, that's not asking a lot of you as the writer to do that. And I'm saying this to me right now. I'm not saying this to anybody else, but I'm saying that I think that story has never appealed to me, and maybe it's because it makes me feel stupid. And so I think that, I don't know. I just thought that was a really good piece of advice for any sort of storytelling medium or any sort of idea. You know, I think when we talk about a movie that's like too artsy and doesn't really make sense, it's because it makes you feel stupid, right? It makes you feel like, I don't get this, but, you know, Interstellar, right? I think people really hated that because they're like, I don't get it. Like, I don't get what's happening. I can't exactly make a through line here. And that makes me mad. And that didn't make me mad because I felt that that's just kind of what it was. Like, the ending was impenetrable. And the ending, to me, wasn't as important as the, you know, the journey. I guess maybe that's it, too, is, like, these kind of stories are definitely journey stories, but they don't have a destination. And if someone's going to invest the time reading a story, I think they expect a payoff of some kind. So there you go. That was one piece of advice that I heard in the room and really took to heart. The other one was... Other one was one that I was like, I want to make a poster that says this and then frame it and hang it. If I was a teacher, I would do that in my classroom. So there was baby clothes in the story, and but we didn't actually know if there was a baby or not. So afterwards, Lydia was asking this person, so was there a baby or not? And she said, I don't know. And she said, well, you put the baby clothes in there, not me. And so... That whole thing, the you put the baby clothes in there, not me, I think is really a perfect way to kind of sum up the... Sometimes there's this frustration in a story where you're like, it has an ambiguous ending, and sometimes that's okay. But sometimes it's too ambiguous, and the ambiguity doesn't help. And so, and if everyone's wondering, was there a baby or not? They read the entire story trying to figure out whether or not there's a baby instead of reading the story and reading the story, you know, when your mind's somewhere else. I think that's also kind of the problem when things are ambiguous in a story and why I don't like ambiguity. I'll tell you, like, the yellow wallpaper, right? The one I've railed about a million times. That story, like the ending especially, is so ambiguous to me. That by the time you get there, I don't really care. And I'm not paying attention to what's happening on the lines. I'm not paying attention. I'm just trying to figure out what the fuck's going on. And so then it all kind of shoots by at the end because I'm not entirely sure what's happening. And so I think this is the thing, is if your mind's in two places at the same time, if you're thinking about what's happening in this story, like if you're thinking, I'm trying to get clues and images to hold on to so I can figure out what exactly is going on here, you're never going to enjoy it because you're not going to be able to relax into the story at all. You're not going to be able to let the storyteller take you, and you kind of don't trust them. You don't trust the storyteller to tell you what's going on. It's funny that when I was working with Tom, he talked about, you know, this thing called stepping out and stepping up. And what it is a thing where you've got a narrator in a story, and they sort of step out of the story and step up and tell you what's going on. And, you know, the phrase he used that was like, this is a stepping out and stepping up phrase is, I didn't know it then, but now I know, da 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 da. And he was like, sometimes just doing that can add clarity to something that needs clarity. And then it helps. It helps the scene, you know, it helps make everyone understand what's going on there. And I think that that's the other thing. I think clarity is always... Here's something I'm learning in this workshop about clarity versus imagery and that kind of thing. You will, like, super please some of your audience with imagery and that kind of thing, right? Like, some people really, really like that stuff. And you can have whole sections of, you know, sort of dreamlike things. And you can do that. However, you're going to lose 20 or 30% of the audience immediately. Like, you're just going to shut down a lot of people immediately. Whereas people who like the sort of more artistic dreamlike stuff, I think aren't as shut down by things that are more explicit, because you can put beauty in there in different ways. I think a lot of language people will still find beauty in language that's like precise or exact or describes something in a way that feels real and authentic. I think you can still please those people that way, but I don't think you'll ever please concrete people with abstract. Like, I just don't think it's going to happen. So, I don't necessarily believe in writing things to the audience that doesn't even exist, because the thing doesn't even exist yet. But I think that there's, like, a strong case to be made for, like, take it easy on the figurative stuff, Pete. Like, don't get crazy with that. Also, if you put a gun in a story, it better do something. I made the mistake, I didn't even realize until after, and I was like, I have this gun in here that basically does nothing. It was just kind of in there. And it's kind of, this is something that happens sometimes, when I'm really cutting a piece for length, stuff kind of stays in there that probably shouldn't be in there, and it's in there basically because it just has made it through every draft. Like, I liked it enough, or it felt it played enough of a part to stay in there through multiple drafts. But by the time I read it out loud and someone points out to me, why do you have a gun in here that basically doesn't do anything? I'm like, yeah, that's really fucking stupid. Like, that is a dumb, weird thing that you did. But there you go. So be it, right? That's what happened. But anyway, it was cool. Like, I think I was nervous. It was very cool to, the people in the class I really enjoy. And also, it was cool to sit with those instructors, and they're sitting there with something I wrote in front of them and, like, giving attention to it. Like, that's just a cool feeling and a cool experience to have. So I really dug that. I really felt like that was a unique thing, that I had never experienced before and was not sure if I'd ever experience again. So I think that was pretty cool. These are all my great words here. That's pretty cool, huh? There was also... we've been talking a lot in the class about, I guess, this sort of philosophical idea Chuck kind of brought up last time, and he was talking about Heidegger and some of these fancy schmancy people, right? And kind of what he was talking about was... So he was talking about in the context of a lot of times in a novel, you'll see that they basically take a road trip at some point. He used examples like Great Gatsby, they go to the city. In Cuckoo's Nest, they go fishing. And the point of the road trip is to sort of break the characters out of this world they've created and to show that there's like this other bigger world. And so then they have to decide sort of, do they continue on in their small little world that's kind of fabricated, or do they address reality and say, okay, I have to be authentic. And it kind of all traces back to this idea, I guess, this Heidegger idea, which is that most of the things we do in our life are to distract us from the fact that we're going to die, and that we'll die and nothing really has meaning. And so the Heidegger thing is everyone kind of figures this out at some point in their life or in some way, right? Everyone's confronted with this fact. And then the sort of big choice of life is, do you retreat back into the inauthentic way you were living before? So, do I kind of realize that? And do I shove it aside by trying to say, well, I am just gonna, do this and that task and maybe take up cross-stitching or something, and that'll help. Or do you accept that you're going to die and then kind of move forward? And then added on to that was kind of, and move forward by deciding that you're going to do the one thing you really want to do. And so his example was like, he decided in his, early 30s, like, okay, I'm going to die. I can't do everything I want to do. Like, there's no lifetime big enough to do everything you want to do, right? Like, I'm not going to be an astronaut. I'm not going to be a computer scientist. I'm not going to be a graphic designer. I'm not going to be this. I'm not going to be that. So what's the thing that I want to do the most? And, you know, the thing he wanted to do the most was be a writer. And he's like, so I went for that. And he's like, it's a risky thing to do because in deciding to go for what you want the most, there's the highest stakes for failure, right? As you, if you work towards something you really, really want, that you really, really want, if you work towards that Spice Girl's dream and you don't get it, then you're like, well, I've put my eggs in that basket and that basket fucking fell apart and burst into flames and someone peed on the ashes. And now I have nothing. But on the other hand, I think it's kind of a... I think there was a truth there of if you kind of go for that, if there's the thing that you're afraid of because you're afraid to fail, that's probably the thing you should be doing, right? That's probably the direction you should go. And he also was talking about how it's kind of a good way to start your life, you know, the authentic portion of life, which is, he was saying, Anne Rice, right? Her daughter got leukemia and died of leukemia. And so everything, you know, in the years or the time leading up to the daughter's death was blood, blood, blood. And that's what got her started to do an interview with a vampire. But, you know, she was writing from this place of nothing, like of zero. I guess a different way of saying you got nothing to lose. And when you've got nothing to lose, that's probably the time to do something. And I think there's, like, a definite wisdom to that. I think that that's probably true. You know, when you've got nothing to lose, that's when you should definitely make a move and do something. I'm feeling like that right now. I mean, I guess I'm feeling good about having made a commitment to writing, because that's what I like. And, you know, going out and going back and forth and stuff. And I guess I do feel like I don't have much to lose in terms of moving out to Oregon right now. I'll miss being close to my mom. That's for sure. But other than that, it's like there are people I like in Colorado. That's the thing that you lose, right? There are people I like out there. But I don't love my job the way I used to. I don't love... I don't love living out there without Cassie. I love my apartment. But I think what I love about it is what it represents for me, which is a peaceful, restful place shut away from the rest of the world. And so that can certainly be recreated somewhere else. That's not something unique to where I am. I just need to find something that fulfills me in a similar way, right? I just need to find a similarly fulfilling sort of living space. But, you know, the good news is my fulfilling living space is a studio apartment on the crappy side of town. It's mostly just, it's like a fairly quiet building. And because it's not built like a fucking house, it's not loud as shit. You don't hear every footfall of your neighbors upstairs. That's all I'm really looking for. So I've had this funny thing at the airport. So I got the TSA pre-check, right? So you go through the metal detector on that instead of the body scan, which means you don't have to empty your pockets except of metal. You don't have to take off your coat. You don't have to do this. You have to take off your belt if you've got a metal belt buckle that's, like, large-ish. Now, they're like, if you've got the big Western kind, you got to do it. But, I don't know, I've had it go off on just kind of a regular man's belt buckle. Not the super skinny kind you wear with a suit, but the kind you'd wear with jeans. So I always just take it off anyway, because I'm like, I got the time, I'm just fucking standing here. But I also have to take off my boots because the winter boots I've been wearing, I guess, have some metal in the arch or something. They're not steel toe. I know that. But they must have some metal inside in the arch, which is pretty common for, like, work boots, I guess. So I just take them off, because I got through one time. The second time I went, tried to go, it didn't work. A third time, it was like, I went through, and then it beeped, but then he's like, eh, try it again. And I went through again, and it didn't beep. So I was like, all right. I just decided, well, the obvious culprit here is the boots. I'll just lose the boots before I go through the line, whatever. Every time I take off my boots in this line, people are like, you don't have to take off your shoes in this line. This has happened to me 3 or 4 times now, someone telling me this. And I'm kind of like, I know that, and like, fuck off. I don't know why it makes me so mad. I think it makes me mad, if I'm guessing at my own emotions. Maybe it's because it's one of those things, you know, where when different people are all telling you the same thing. When you're like, I get so frustrated. I remember there's this, like, David Sedaris story that really encapsulates this phenomenon. And he was talking about how his dad walks, he has, like, 2 Great Danes or something. And he's always walking the dogs, and people always make the same joke about, like, oh, who's walking who? And he's like, my dad is always just kind of like, haha, thumbs up, you know, and goes along with it. And he's like, but after staying with him for a week, I see people, different people make this same joke, like, every day. Every day. And his dad hears it, like, every day from somebody else. And he's just like, how can you take that? Like, how can you... People are so fucking unoriginal and horrible. But then he tells this story about how he was at a taxidermy shop, right? And they had a bunch of shit around. And one of the things they had was, like, this bowl of eyeballs. And he was, like, looking at this bowl of eyeballs, and above it was this note that said, please do not pick up the eyeballs and put them in front of your own eyes. And he was talking to the owner about it, because he was like, it must just make it, it must just be one of these things that makes everyone crazy, you know what I mean? Because everyone does it. And the guy was like, everyone does it. But actually the reason for the note is because the way the, you know, the eyeballs are turned into glass, it leaves this pointy part, and they put the pointy part sort of right on the back of the eyeball. So people are pointing this, like, sharp glass shard right into their eyes when they do that. So it's, like, really a terrible, dangerous thing to do. And he's like, everyone does it. Like, everybody does it. When they see these eyeballs, they put them in front of their own eyes. And what really horrifies David Sedaris is he's like, I was about to do that. Like, that's what I wanted to do when I saw these eyeballs before I saw this sign that said not to. And he's like, so I'm just like everyone else. And everyone does this, right? But there's something that's really annoying about that, isn't there? There's something really annoying and obnoxious about somebody making that same joke. Okay, here's the other thing. Every time I go through, so I've got my driver's license. I didn't actually have to go in the last time I renewed it. It was an online renewal or whatever. So I didn't have to get a new picture or anything like that. So I've got long hair in it, you know, that's kind of like wild looking. And so every single time someone sees it, they go like, oh, you got a haircut. Like every security person, everyone at a bar, or they'll be like, pretty major haircut. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I did. Like 8 years ago. I sure did. And it's just so annoying for some reason. But I think the boots thing is extra annoying. Because today it's like this lady is behind me in line. She's like, oh, you don't have to take off your shoes in the TSA pre-check line. And I was like, before she could even finish, I was already breathing in to say, these boots have metal in them. But it's just like, what difference does it make? I've already got the boots off. They're already off. So what are you saving me at that point? You're just like, you just want me to know that I'm dumb. Is that it? You just want me to know? Well, for future reference, you don't have to do that. Okay. Listen, I don't care. Don't tell me something after I've already done it. After it's already too late, don't tell me. Because what am I going to do? Put my boots back on? I got to put them back on either way. So whether or not I do it before or after the security thing, what difference does it make to you?
And what harm is it doing to you that I take my boots off?
Believe me, I'm faster through the security line than anyone you'll meet. All right? There's no chance you're going to be faster than I am. And then I got through the lady today. I get through the line, and then I take my shit and I'm walking away, and she's like, "Sir, sir," and she's like yelling to me. And I turn around, and she's like, "You left your cell phone," and there was a cell phone in the dish. It was the guy in front of me, his cell phone, and I was just like, "That's not mine." I was like, "Mom, do you have a kid that you need to go parent somewhere, like a grown child that you miss parenting? Because, like, I got this. I know what I'm doing. I know you're just trying to help, but, like, I don't know, mind your own fucking business." And it's like, maybe that phone belongs to the person whose pile of shit is all right there. That's the thing about the airport, right? That's the thing I've been saying, is it's just, never in your life do you feel more like a number and a not individual than at the airport. Like, it's just, you are not a person, you are just, like, passenger 57. Always bet on black, as I believe the slogan went. I never saw that Passenger 57. I kind of for a while was thinking, like, maybe I should watch all these great airplane heist movies. Anything that involves an airplane in a significant way. So I was like, Executive Decision. But it turns out, like, nobody's got that. And then I thought, Passenger 57. I never saw that one. I feel like there was some movie where, like, Jodie Foster's on an airplane and somehow her daughter gets, like, kidnapped on the airplane or something. And I have no idea what happens, but I suspect there's some kind of psychological element where she never had a daughter or something. Because I can't figure out exactly how you would sort of smuggle a person off an airplane
without anyone noticing.
If there's ever been a place where it's, like, can your kid go to the bathroom by themselves? I'd be like, I guess on the fucking airplane, because, like, where are they going to go? There's, like, nowhere for them to go. They can't really get into anything because everything's locked. There's, like, no doors. There's no open chairs. I mean, there's nothing. There is nothing. So, I don't know. Maybe that's it. I was trying to remember. I remember Final Destination, one of those, had a pretty horrific plane crash in it. And then also, I guess Lost, that began with a plane crash. Which was pretty good, too, although I feel like it's not really a plane-based thing. It's just like, well, there was a plane crash, and that's what initiates everything, but whatever. That was a show, that and, like, Sons of Anarchy, that I burned out on when I was 80% through the show. And now I'm like, I guess I could read, like, the Wikipedia up to where I was. Because Lost, it's probably been, like, 10 years since I started going through it. And I really enjoyed the first 3 or 4 seasons and then was like, eh.
All right, now I'm bored.
Whatever season it was where they weren't on the island anymore and they're like, we gotta get back to the island, I was like, do we? Or don't we? And if we gotta get back there, shouldn't we have just stayed there? Not interested, thanks. And then Sons of Anarchy, I can't even remember what happened, really, but I just kind of was like, oh, these boys are always making trouble. And then some fool spoiled the ending for me. Even though I kind of suspected the ending, but it was why do people do that? I gotta tell you the ending of stuff. And then they're always like, it's okay, because that happened so long ago. And it's like, you know, we live in a world, this is the thing I feel about spoilers right now. We live in this world of such abundant media. Not everybody doesn't see everything. I've never seen Breaking Bad, ever. And, like, maybe I'll watch it someday. I mean, I have seen, like, the first season, perhaps. But, you know, I don't know most of the characters. Cassie was like, we should watch Better Call Saul. It's really good. And we were watching it, and I was just like, I mean, I don't understand what's happening. I don't know any of these characters. This is totally insignificant to me, and this is not going to work. And so somebody could reasonably spoil Breaking Bad, I guess, because it's like, yeah, it's old. But also, I think we just need to find a better way to talk about shit without spoiling it, right? Like, can you tell me what you enjoyed about something without spoiling it? Could you tell me what you enjoyed about, you know, Marvel Civil War without telling me Spider-Man's in it? You know what I mean? Do you have to tell me that? I'm just using that as an example because that fucker was in the trailer, so obviously, I don't know. Anything that's in the trailer, I feel, is fair game, right? Even though I'd rather not see it.
Or like Thor Ragnarok, how much can you not tell me anything about it and convince me to go see it?
I feel like that's like the job of a great reviewer, is they figure out the way they can tell you the least about what happens so that you can enjoy the discovery yourself, and still convince you to see it, or whether or not it's kind of in your wheelhouse. Like, I just wish there were reviewers. I need to find some reviewers who are to my taste. Because I just think that it would be great to see a reviewer who's like, you know, I don't know, Edge of Tomorrow. It's like, this is a really fun movie. It's a little bit dark, but overall pretty good. If you liked something like Starship Troopers, you'll like this. It's got the same sort of edgy comedy to it. It's got a, you know, futuristic, militaristic setting. And not a lot of time wasted on backstory. Not a lot of time wasted screwing around with, like, filling in a lot of character background. Because you don't need it. It does not matter. And that's it. That's all I need to know, right? Isn't that enough for me to know enough to make it through? Or to know, okay, yeah, if someone's saying, if you like Starship Troopers, you should watch this. Then I'm like, alright, I'm in. Still have not seen the new Star Wars. my life has taken a little bit of a turn. I've been living a very strange life the last couple weeks. 6 weeks, I guess, now. I'm halfway through, you guys. But this quarter of the year has been very odd, because it's just like I spend 14 hours a week traveling from one place to another, and for a 3.5-hour workshop that's like pretty surreal and great. And you know, there's no days where I wake up anymore and it's a question of like, what am I going to do today? What does Pete want to do today? That is not a question that is asked. Because it does not matter. Because what Pete wants to do today is irrelevant. It's, what does Pete got to do today? And then I have all these little jobs to do in the meantime, right? Like, all the little things that you have to do to keep your life together become this, like, desperate situation for me. When am I going to squeeze in a load of laundry so I have clothes to wear? You know, when am I going to squeeze in a trip to the grocery store and then time that so I can also cook the food that I purchased before it's like ruined? When am I going to do all these things? You got to like fit it all in this weird sort of wedging it in kind of way. But I don't know. I guess it's nice because it's a different experience, right? It's a different life. For a quarter of the year, I'm living a different life. I just finished writing a column about, it was like a book list column about books that are for people who are single and enjoy being single, which I thought was like an oddly unexplored territory, because it's not like, you know, I think a lot of people think, all right, single people are not single by choice ever. And also, they're not like, I think you can find a real happiness in single life. Don't take me wrong. Let's not, everything I'm about to say is like, I've found happiness in single life and sort of, what do you want to call it? Connected life? Not single life? Dating life? You know, I've been very happy with Poon Master Flex, but I've also been happy before when I was single. And I think that's like a real thing. How angry does it make you when you like go to pass someone in a slow ass, smelly ass, dually diesel truck, and they fucking speed up as soon as you start to go around them? They're going like 8 miles below the speed limit, and then they're going 5 miles above the speed limit. Because you're like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing with your life? Anyway, it kind of made me just think about, like, single life and how it's good. And Valentine's Day is, like, tomorrow. And I wondered, maybe it's time for my annual defense of Valentine's Day. My devil's advocate in favor of Valentine's. All right, number one. I think the argument about it being sort of a Hallmark holiday is bullshit. Because I think that's just an easy way to dismiss Valentine's Day. It's just an easy way to say, like, ugh, that's dumb. And you're dumb for wanting to do it. And I don't think it rings true to me. It doesn't seem realistic. Like, Valentine's is a Hallmark holiday, but, like, Easter is a... What do you do on Easter? You hide little eggs and stuff? Like, that's a big... Well, that's not consumer at all. Like, that's just all... Whatever. You know, I don't know. You go on a date, you go to a nice restaurant, and it's like, well, I feel a lot better about supporting a nice restaurant than I do about supporting, like, Amazon around Christmas. I mean, how... I don't know. I would be entirely unsurprised to learn, you know, well, it's definitely started from a Hallmark sort of someone invented this holiday. But I think it's turned out okay. Like, I think it's not a big deal. Here's the thing that's a big deal about Valentine's Day. Sometimes people pretend they don't care about Valentine's Day, and they totally do. That's bad. I think it's also bad to do the thing like sending flowers to your wife at her work. Because I feel like that's such a conspicuous show of love as to, I don't know, it's like, why you gotta give her... Why does everyone else gotta know how you feel about your wife? Like, doesn't she just need to know? Isn't that really all that matters, is that she knows that how you feel? It's a little try hard. It's a little loud. Okay, let's tone that down. I think, like, the other thing is everyone's like, I don't need a love day to tell me how to do my life and whatever. And I'm like, I think you do. Because I think most of us aren't great at that, right? I don't send Cassie a lot of cards just because. And I probably should. And I did, you know, I had been sending her the postcards and letters and stuff, but now I see her every week, so I haven't been doing that. But I probably should. But I got her Valentine's Day card. I was gonna buy her chocolates, but she had chocolate already that I bought her from Christmas, and she was like, I don't want any more. She was like, I don't want to be a fatty. And I was like, well, I don't think you're a fatty, but if you don't want me to buy these for you, because that's just gonna cause conflicting feelings for you, like, it's gonna cause a mixture of guilt when you eat it, then fine, I won't buy it. I don't need to buy it for my sake. So there you go. I think that it's just like, it's good to have reminders of these things. Like, I think what's good about Thanksgiving, right, is it forces you to hang out with your family. Like, We could absolutely have a meal with family any fucking day we just decided, right? Like, couldn't every family just declare its own Thanksgiving pretty easily? And it's like, let's just do it when it's convenient for us. But we don't, and we're not going to. And, like, I think this is the sort of stuff that humans are really bad at. We have, like, great intentions, but we are really bad at doing sort of consistent things when there's not an artificial stakes there or some kind of pressure, maybe I should say. We're just not very good at that. I think this is why most, you know, exercise regimens fail, diets fail. I think this is why relationships fail sometimes, is we're not good about going out with each other and, like, spending time with each other and not being... spending time with each other where we're not on the phone and we're not, you know, oh, I'm surfing on my computer and she's surfing on hers and we're kind of like, check this out, check that out. It's like, I mean, we went for a walk and it was nice. I would suggest that. If you're dating somebody or you guys are looking for an activity, go for a fucking walk, man. It's great. You walk around, you talk, it's nice. And you can really just talk about some shit. So, I don't know, just make Valentine's Day. Just do it, but just do it your own way. If they like cards, get them a card. If they like flowers, get flowers. Just do it. And, you know, maybe part of it, too, is like, hey, part of Valentine's Day is that you gotta make the effort, right? And if you're unwilling to make that effort, then whatever. I think here's the thing is, like, you want to recapture this... I remember being, like, a young man, and, you know, you're in high school. You wanted to do something awesome on Valentine's Day for your girlfriend, right? Because you're like, all right, this is a great time to demonstrate my love and outdo myself and whatever. And maybe Valentine's Day as an adult is kind of a good chance to recapture some of that shit. Recapture some of that, like, good feeling about relationships and love and just that sort of, like, I want to be loved. I may have to do some things to be deserving of love. I feel like I'm saying the word love a lot here. And I'm not comfortable with that. Not comfortable with that at all. I have another movie I watched that I can review for you. It was Miracle. The story of the Winter Olympics. I watched the opening ceremony for the Winter Olympics, by the way. What the fuck? I mean, it's spectacular, but it's also... how the fuck do they come up with this? Like, they just send some guy out in the desert with peyote and say, like, tell us what you saw, and then we'll turn it into reality with, like, floating LEDs and, like, synchronized snowboarding and all crazy shit. You know, we're gonna sing this old Korean song about, you know, how there's something beautiful and even in something tragic, and have these weird technological things going on and, like, weird synchronized dancing. And there's always some performer at an Olympics opening ceremony who's, like, 2 years old. And I'm like, ah, this is the portion of the program where we all feel like shit for our life choices. Because we're like, I mean, if that kid's that good at the violin at two, I certainly could have passably played the piano at my age, right? Like, a couple lessons, I should be able to do that. I should be able to hammer into the piano after a while. I just think the opening ceremony is so weird, because who's that for? And, like, you go into it with really no idea what to expect, but you know what kind of thing to expect. You know it's going to be, like, weird and artsy and dancey and singy. And, just so strange. I need to, like, remind myself to do a show where I'm going to watch some opening ceremonies from, like, years past. Because I bet watching them from the years past is pretty amazing. And I have no idea, like, I have no real memory of, like, in the 90s. Is this what it was like in the 90s, too? Or is this, like, a newer thing? I remember they came up with, like, a 90s Olympic mascot guy. Who, you know, he had, like, cartoon eyes and gloves on, and he's, like, a blue thing. Maybe his name was Izzy. I can't remember. But anyway, I just wonder, maybe that was the 90s thing they did, right? They're like, let's come up with a mascot for the Olympics. And then maybe the now thing is, let's do this very artistic, multicultural acid trip. Everybody can go on together. It's just so weird. Like, I don't know who's watching that and thinking, like, wow, that's amazing. Because, I mean, it is amazing in that it's, like, it is cool that they managed to make this happen. But I don't really know why. I don't really know what purpose it serves. I don't get it. I don't get it. And I don't get why they have like all these like songs and stuff, because it's like, I mean, can't you just sing the national anthem and move on? And isn't that good enough? I mean, how many fucking songs do you need for the same thing? It's just very weird. I think it's weird too, like, they always pan and show the athletes sitting there, and I'm like, that's gotta be an odd thing that they're like, when you're an athlete, it seems like you're kind of like a student on a field trip, and they're just like, okay, now you gotta go do this, and you're like, seriously, I gotta go to the fucking opening? I would not want to go to the opening ceremony if I was an athlete, because I'd be like, I mean, no offense, but like, I'm not really into musical theater, man. Like, I don't like that shit. That's why I'm a power lifter, because I don't like singing and dancing. And this seems pretty much the opposite, right? Getting some awesome bass from somebody's cool car. I don't really understand, like, I don't really understand. I think I dislike the Winter Olympics quite a bit, because I think the events are dumber. I mean, okay. Figure skating, I don't like that at all. It's like they do a bunch of dancing around and stuff, and it's just like, I mean, that's cool, but we all just want to see you jump and spin around like 5 times, right? And then do the thing where you duck down and spin around really fast. But they're kind of all doing the same tricks. It's just like the costumes and the dancey part that's different. You know, it's like, well, they're all going to grab this chick by her ankles and fucking swing her around so her face is, like, right next to the ice. Which I guess is cool, but it's just sort of like, what am I watching, the Olympics or watching a freak show? Like, that's something they would do in the circus. Where's the event where they throw knives at a chick who's strapped onto a spinning circle of wood? Why isn't that an event, if this one is? And you never see, like, you know, people say, like, oh, people watch NASCAR for the crashes, which is, like, I don't think that's true, because if that was true, why would they go 500 miles? They would just go, like, 50 and then be there for 20 minutes. I mean, I would love to see one of those crashes. I just don't know what happens. Like, does the lady's face just get plowed into the ice? Does she die? Would you die from that? I don't know. Seems like you might. I feel like if someone grabbed me by the ankles and swung me full speed into a wall, I might die. Like, swung my head into a brick wall, I feel like I would die. Probably. I'd be fucked up. I don't really understand, too, like, certain sports, like powerlifting, for example. Why is that a summer sport? They're not doing it outside. They're doing it in a building, so who cares? Like, you might as well just make some of the other shit a summer sport and a winter sport. Because what's the difference? I mean, you know, if someone's throwing a pole vault doing a pole vault indoors as opposed to outdoors, like, who cares? What's the difference? I don't know. I don't get it. I don't really get it. I think the winter sports are just kind of more boring. And I think they're more boring because it's like, there's way more of watching. All right, you watch these two guys do the ski run. Then you watch these two guys do it. Then you watch these two. And it's just, you're watching two people do the exact same thing over and over. And if you told me, like, oh, this is this guy and he's really great at it, and this person's sort of mediocre, I'd be like, I saw no difference at all. Or then, like, the bobsled. Like I've seen Cool Runnings many times, and I have no idea still how that works or why. How do you even get into that? I mean, let's set aside the Jamaican bobsled team for a bit, because that obviously was enough of a story to be, you know, a movie with John Candy and Dougie Doug in it. So let's just put that aside. How do you even, as someone in Canada, get involved in bobsled? Like in high school? Do they have a high school bobsled? I have never met anybody who's ever been on a bobsled. I mean, I've never met anyone. You would think they would have somewhere like a bobsled course where they're like, oh yeah, we just kind of put this big sled that can't really tip over on there. And then it's too wide and it goes slower. It's not meant for speed, but it's pretty thrilling. Like going 25 miles an hour on a bobsled, if you've never done it, it's like a roller coaster. You'd think they would have done that. And maybe they do, like wherever the fuck bobsled happens, they're doing that. But I don't know where that is. And how do you get there? And like, what's the cost? How does this, why do the bobsledders have to wear pants that are like, you know, tights material? Like their legs are inside the bobsled. Are they getting wind resistance in the sled? I would think not. That would be a poorly designed sled if they were. But I don't know, or like the, what's that fucking crazy one? The skeleton boarding or skeleton sledding or whatever they call that? That's fucked up. The luge. The luge is super fucked up. That is just like, that just seems like you're just trying not to die. Doesn't it? I mean, how do you learn how to luge? Is there like a beginning luge course that's like fairly flat or something? Because that just seems very difficult to learn. It seems like a steep learning curve. When you hit that first steep curve, I just feel like luge is something you'd learn a lot about real quick or not. You'd just fall and then you would just slide on your face on this ice for, you know, a million miles and be like, well, I don't think I'm going to luge again. I'm a luger. So why don't you kill me? Jeez, a rock just hit the window. Yeah, and like, I don't know, they've got so many events that are like the same thing. I'm not gonna lie, track and field is kind of similar. I mean, what difference do I care if it's the 110 hurdles or the, whatever, you know, 400 meter hurdles or something? I mean, do I really care? Is there really a difference there to me? I don't think so. 100 meter, I feel like, let's do the 100 meter dash, the 400, the 8, the mile. And call it a day. That's enough. But even as someone who's interested in that, I don't watch it. I mean, I would never be like incensed if they removed a thing from track and field. I'd be like, you can't take away shot put. What are they supposed to do instead? Just the discus?
That's insane. That's insane. If I can't
watch a guy throw a heavy cannonball around, what am I going to do with my life? How am I going to, you know, put the veil back down that Heidegger was talking about and pretend that life isn't meaningless if I don't have a shot-putting event to distract me? That's what I need. That's the only thing that can keep my mind off the inevitable end here. But yeah, it's just, and then you watch them do it too, and it's like, okay, the downhill skiing, then you've got the moguls or something, then you've got like the ski jump, then you've got this, and it's like, I mean, the first one you watch, the first heat or whatever that you watch is pretty fun, and then after that you're like, eh, okay. I watched part of the Summer Olympics the last time it happened. I was at Poon Master Flex's mom's house, and she fell asleep, and me and her mom watched some of the Olympics. And it was really funny because they were talking a lot about the basketball team that year, because the basketball team was showing up to the, you know, the coach was like, we want to have you guys be more like the dream team, you know, and everyone loved and whatever. And he's like, you guys need to show up to some other events and support your fellow American athletes. And they're like, okay, so, you know, we're watching them and they're at beach volleyball. And everyone's like, there's the basketball team. Good for them, man. And I was like, oh, yeah. What a sacrifice for them to watch some of the fittest women in the world in the tiniest bikinis in the world play beach volleyball in Brazil. Like, what a sacrifice they've made for their country. I'm so proud of them. I mean, I was just like, we're all giving them a big hand, and it's like, eh. I mean, I think they've got the time. I think they could kill some time watching. How hard is it to convince a bunch of dudes to go watch a bunch of chicks play beach volleyball? And to be like, listen, you could go watch this beach volleyball or not. But you're basically in Brazil. You're kind of like trapped in this Olympic Village or whatever. And also, if you go watch these chicks play volleyball in tiny bikinis, everyone's going to talk about how heroic that was. It's kind of like a fantasy of mine to be in a situation where people are, you know, giving me a standing ovation because I watched beach volleyball. They're like, wow, bravo, what heroes. I think like watching that miracle movie, it's kind of funny. There's a little coda at the end. And it's talking about dream teams, right? And how after a couple years after the miracle on ice, there was most of the hockey teams and then the basketball and all that were made up of professional athletes. Whereas before it had always been, you know, amateurs, usually college players, right? Who weren't professional hockey players or professional basketball players. And I think I like that better. Like, I think I like the idea of sending non-professional athletes to do this shit. Because it's kind of like in swimming, right? You can be a professional swimmer, but it's not like being a professional basketball player where you're like, well, I've got this, you know, $100 million contract and da-da-da-da. I mean, okay, here's the thing. I think that professional basketball players, professional hockey players, professional these people have a lot of opportunities to leverage their skills to make a living and to for the world to see how great they are at what they do. And like amateurs don't really have that chance the same way. Or, you know, college players. Like, who's watching college hockey? Anybody? And so I think it's great to sort of, I don't know. I wouldn't mind seeing a return to that. I just feel like that was a simpler time. It was a better time. This is Pete longing for a past that he doesn't even remember because he was like 6 years old. But hey, it's true. I don't know. I think it just makes it more exciting too. It's like, yeah, like when our professional basketball players go and trounce the basketball teams from other countries. I mean, it's like, it's a total hollow victory. It would be like if somebody, let's see, who would be a good person? If Joyce Carol Oates disliked a review I wrote of one of her books and challenged me to a boxing match, I would absolutely not do that. I mean, because I don't really want to hit Joyce Carol Oates, but also because, like, that is the definition of a lose-lose proposition. Because think about it like this. Two possible outcomes. One, I go and, you know, completely destroy Joyce Carol Oates in the boxing ring. Well, no one's going to give me any props for that. Because they're going to be like, yeah, you're like a young man who's in decent shape. And she's like a frail... She's a woman who has looked like a frail old woman since she was 25. And she's fairly old. Like, I hope you're very proud of yourself. It's a very hollow victory, right? Other scenario, Joyce Carol Oates win. And then, you're the guy who got the shit kicked out of him by Joyce Carol Oates. That's why it's a lose-lose proposition. It's not just about her being a woman, either. It's like, who's a guy who's like, I should easily be able to beat up? Like a super old man. I don't know. I'm trying to think of like an old man who's not athletic and whatever, and everyone would just be like, thanks a lot. Yeah, okay. It'd be like if I beat the shit out of Morgan Freeman in a boxing ring. Is anyone gonna be proud of me? Or like, hey, nice job. Everyone's gonna be like, why did you beat up Morgan Freeman? That's kind of fucked up. Or if I lost, everyone would be like, look how fucking awesome Morgan Freeman is, and what a fucking idiot this guy is. This guy could not even take a 90-year-old man in the ring. So it's like, that's definitely lose-lose. All right. Well, I've made it. Well, I'm quote-unquote home. I'm at the gymnasium. This is what I've been doing. I've been going straight from the airport when I get home. I eat a sandwich as I walk through the walkway from the terminal. And then come to the gymnasium and exercise. So I leave Poon Master Flex's place at like 7:45 Pacific time. And get home at about, 5:45 here time. So it ends up being like a, full day. By the time I get there, sometimes I've gone home, but I know if I go home, like, that's it. I'm not going back out. There's no fucking way. There's no fucking way I'm getting back in the car to drive out this way to, where I have to drive out for work every day. This is the downside of your gym being close to your work, is that it's like, on the days you don't have to go out there, you really don't want to, because you're like, it's kind of far. And the library is kind of far. Branch library. Okay. Obviously, I'm done. So I'll see you next time.